This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. You've probably read recently a lot of people are concerned about receiving a COVID vaccine, but fears about vaccines in this country is nothing new. From as early as 1796 and the introduction of the first smallpox vaccine, people have shown apprehension. In Maya Goldenberg's new book, Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science, she reframes vaccine hesitancy as a crisis of public trust rather than a war on science, arguing that having good scientific support of vaccine efficacy and safety is not enough. I spoke earlier with Dr. Goldenberg ahead of her virtual visit this week to the Mercantile Library. Here is our pre-recorded interview. Joining us now is Dr. Maya J. Goldenberg, the author of the new book, Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. Dr. Goldenberg, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
I'm fascinated because you opened this book detailing that you spent 5 years researching it, writing it, revising it. And then as you prepare to submit the final manuscript to your publisher, here comes COVID. Can you share with us what that experience was like working on a book exploring this topic only to see something this world-changing take shape?
It took me, I think like many of us, it took a moment to get my bearings. So when I first realized that this, you know, this disease that started in, at this point, we were sort of watching it spreading in China and Iran and into Italy. And at some point, it became very obvious that those of us in the States, and I'm in Canada, were going to be severely impacted by it. So I took a pause because I wondered if, at least with my book, if I needed an extra chapter or something like that to sort of account for what I knew was going to be a new chapter in vaccine hesitancy. So all my work had been on pediatric vaccine hesitancy. And I said, well, this new virus will eventually have a new vaccine, and we're going to have a new face of vaccination and vaccine hesitancy around that. What I ended up doing in the end was realizing, well, first of all, I realized that anything that I would say about this future vaccine wasn't going to do it justice. So instead, I wrote a preface to the reader just saying where I was at in early 2020 and that I imagined that we would be dealing with a new wave of vaccine hesitancy and issues around vaccines in the near future. And that the themes that I bring out in the book around public trust and difficulties with expertise and science and the public were going to be as relevant as ever. And I think at least so far it's panned out.
Oh my gosh, no kidding. I've read this book obviously in preparation of the interview, and with COVID so heavy on the mind, it totally resonated throughout. Obviously learned a whole lot of additional things while reading this too. And at the risk of spending too much time on the business side of things, I just want to ask, I mean, what were the conversations like with a publisher? I mean, on one hand, I suppose as terrible of a tragedy as this is, it's a good thing that you were putting so much work into researching this issue because of the timing.
Yes, the timing was helpful that way, and it's a reminder that that humanities and social science research is helpful for understanding complex problems, because the science is changing, but some of the themes, including the ones that I bring out in the book, are stay with us. So, you know, when I was trying to make sense of COVID, like many of us, I was found myself looking towards history books about past plagues and outbreaks, because I wanted to get a sense of where we were relative to others and where we're going. So I find humanities research actually helpful for making sense of things that seem very new, like we've never seen it before. But in fact, we do have this history and this history of thought as well that is helpful for framing contemporary issues.
The name of the book is Vaccine Hesitancy, and you note that that is different than vaccine refusal or vaccine acceptance. Would you define vaccine hesitancy for us?
Certainly. Vaccine hesitancy is a feeling of ambivalence around vaccines or vaccination. So it is distinct from the behavior. The behavior of interest might be vaccine refusal, but I'm going to say maybe around eight years ago, it really came into focus in public health research that the behavior is not the only thing you want to be keeping an eye on. You also want to look at the feelings behind it. Now vaccine hesitancy, as I said, it's a feeling, and that includes a far greater number of people than vaccine refusal. So there are, by some studies, they do a lot of quantification of vaccine hesitancy, depending how you define it, because it is on a spectrum from a little bit unsure to very unsure about vaccines. You might get as much as 40% of Americans with young children demonstrate some element of vaccine hesitancy. Now, some of those people will still vaccinate their children, and some of them won't, and some of them will try to, let's say, do some kind of modified schedule where, let's say, you skip some or you delay some or unbundle the ones that are put together, like measles, mumps, rubella. What public health came to recognize was that you had to keep an eye on the attitude, not just the behavior, because it informs how you want to communicate about vaccines. And if those communications go badly, those hesitators might end up being refusers. So you want it to go well.
We're talking with Dr. Maya Goldenberg, an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Guelph in Canada. Her new book is Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. Dr. Goldenberg will be featured at the Mercantile Library in a virtual speaker event on Wednesday, March 31 at 7 p.m. More details at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Dr. Goldenberg, you write in the book, quote, vaccine hesitancy runs along the spectrum from mild to severe uncertainty about whether vaccines are safe, effective, and necessary. So we've got this spectrum to talk about. And in this particular situation with a new coronavirus and multiple very new vaccines, difficult to measure. Is it difficult to measure as it relates to hesitancy right now? It seems like there would likely be more people otherwise open to well-established vaccines who would be concerned about these new ones.
The numbers, at least when they first started trying to quantify how many people are vaccine hesitant, they were seeing numbers sort of similar to the numbers you saw around pediatric vaccines. And that doesn't mean it's the same people, but you got roughly the same percentages. And those numbers are shifting. And I'll say a little bit about how the publics are responding to coronavirus. So on the one hand, the coronavirus vaccine is seen as more problematic by the public because it's new vaccine. We don't have the long-term data. We don't have the established information around it like we do with pediatric vaccines, because some of those vaccines have been around for decades, so we generally know them to be safe and effective. So there was worry about the newness of it. At the same time, there is so much at stake with these vaccines that a lot of people are going to say, I'm willing to take it because I want to get back to normal. I'm my life is being threatened in a way that, at least in industrialized countries, people don't feel that kind of urgency around pediatric vaccination. And as an aside, that's because most kids are vaccinated. That's why we don't often need to worry about major outbreaks. Even outbreaks of measles, we're often talking about, let's say, 100 or 150 cases, which is, of course, 150 cases too many. But if it shows you that there's a lot of vaccination in place, that we're not talking about thousands and thousands. So that's what we're seeing around coronavirus. The newness of it is making people uncomfortable, but the urgency of it is also compelling people towards getting it. We're also seeing that it's becoming normalized as more and more people, at least in the United States, are getting vaccinated. Other people who were more uncertain or were sort of saying, I'd like to get it, but I don't want to be first, are now seeing that their peers and their groups are doing it and are doing okay, so they're more likely to be accepting of it.
I would imagine then that the stakes are pretty high for vaccine proponents right now, with watching how this plays out, who ultimately decides to get it, how critical the vaccines will be and moving beyond this pandemic. Do you have any sense of what the stakes might be as it relates to your research on vaccine hesitancy?
Well, the stakes are high in countries like the U.S., where all other measures to mitigate the spread of the virus have been largely unsuccessful. I mean, we have all kinds of non-pharmaceutical public health measures like contact tracing, social distancing, masking, that have worked well in some countries that implemented them with a lot of public health resources and effort. However, in countries that didn't invest in that way, the vaccine is kind of our last shot. This is how the United States is going to get out of this, because public health measures were not enacted in even moderately effective ways.
You have so much interesting information in this book that might even run counter to some of our just generalized understanding of science and vaccines. And we've seen a lot of news reports in recent months as the vaccines emerged about which general demographics might be more hesitant or resistant to take a COVID vaccine. For example, Black and brown populations in the U.S. have been cited because of previous malicious medical studies. But based on your research, you report in the book that across the world, the highest rates of vaccine hesitancy is in the most economically developed nations, while poorer countries like Bangladesh and Rwanda have the highest rates of acceptance. Can you tell us why?
What I can tell you is that I don't know specific to each location, but what it does tell you is that the extent to which people are confident about vaccines is determined by that population's relationship to the system. So you'll find that in countries with relatively stable healthcare systems and stable economies, and as well as fairly good access to vaccines, it's usually the most marginalized. It's usually the most marginalized populations that are the most resistant to it. And that speaks to how they see themselves in relation to the system. If people think the system, whether that's a healthcare system or government more broadly, is not acting in the interest of their community, they're going to have some hesitation around vaccines. So vaccine becomes a little bit of a signal there of broader relationships of trust between people and government and scientific institutions.
How do we square that with the research that you present related to, I think you specifically cite California coastal residents, for example, who seem to be more averse to taking a vaccine or administering a vaccine to their children because of the false risk of autism?
Right. So there is misinformation out there, like that autism thesis that is part of it. But what I did in my work was shifting away from the assumption, and it's quite a prevalent assumption, that it is somehow scientific misunderstanding and illiteracy that is driving vaccine hesitancy. I think that you've got bodies of people that are unhappy for some reason about the scientific institutions, about their relationship to them, and they look for theories to help justify that belief. So the prevalence of the autism thesis is not because people really don't understand science, it's because people are looking to grasp onto a theory that justifies their resistance towards vaccines. So thinking about coastal Californians, this is a puzzle to many people. These are, of course, the people that benefit the most from the system. So why are they resistant to it? Well, if you actually listen to what they say, you can read their accounts, personal narratives, their social science research, talking to parents, there are points of resistance that they are not happy with. So a lot of parents, regardless of their socioeconomic status, say that they're uncomfortable with how the pharmaceutical industry influences health research and practice. So they think something isn't working well in that system, and science is not always being deployed in the interests of the people, but rather in the interests of corporate power or government power. So even people with high socioeconomic status believe this. In fact, they might believe it more just because they have more access to all the examples demonstrating this. You know, we have an opioid crisis, we have a medical device crisis. I could go on and on. There's a lot of reasons to not fully trust that industry and academic relationships are working well. So this is the kind of thing that they cite. Also, there is a preponderance of mothers that are vaccine hesitant around childhood vaccines. And that says something about, first of all, who makes healthcare decisions in the family. It's usually the mothers and their relationship to healthcare. It is not surprising to anyone who does health studies if by what I'm going to tell you is that women generally have a poorer healthcare, generally have poorer healthcare encounters than men. Women are often not listened to. Their symptoms are not believed, especially around pain management. So you've got this group of mothers who have maybe had poor healthcare experiences in the past, trying to, let's say, speak to their physicians about their concerns about vaccines, and they get shut down. And that ties into a past experience people have had. This sort of injustice where people don't listen to women and tend to trivialize their concerns. And this has been known to sometimes get women active and looking for information elsewhere, and sometimes even mobilizing that concern. And that seems to be what's happening among affluent women. They're frustrated with their healthcare experiences, and they go looking for community elsewhere.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our guest today is Dr. Maya Goldenberg, an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Guelph. We're discussing the new book, Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. It's part of a virtual presentation on Wednesday, March 31 at the Mercantile Library at 7 o'clock. You can find details at wvxu.org. Maya, I want to touch on part of that subtitle, and you did just touch a little bit on it, as well as something else I want to explore coming up, but the war on science. You write in this book, quote, "Wars and battle metaphors frame the issue as us versus them, good versus evil. Such framing minimizes the need to understand the perspective of the other or to find compromise." And that seems to be true of just about all areas of public life right now. And I'm wondering what the danger is of that framing as you see it when it comes to medicine.
The danger of it is that we don't bring people to where we want them to be in a just and informed kind of way. So when I think about what is a physician trying to do when, let's say, they meet a patient who wants to talk about pediatric vaccines, they're supposed to provide the information so that patients can make an informed choice. Instead, these kinds of conversations often go badly. This is recorded in empirical literature and in the narratives where, let's say, a mother goes to speak to her physician. That's usually where people go for healthcare decisions. First, they go to their healthcare provider, wants to talk about pediatric vaccines, and they get shut down and made to feel selfish or stupid for doing that. So right away, it creates this hostile environment between the provider and the patient, or at least the parent of the patient in some cases. And you can't move from there. You get a little bit stuck. So you, now I'm hearing, now we have the experiences of frustrated parents finding each other and creating these communities where they might actually become more vaccine resistant. We've also got extremely frustrated physicians who say things like, we should kick patients out of our practices if they refuse to vaccinate their children. All the while, the care that's needed and the understanding that goes into the care to make it go well are not happening, because you've got divisions here that don't need to happen. Instead, if things went better, you'd have a context where mothers are allowed to ask questions, physicians answer them patiently. Physicians should also be given the time and remuneration for doing that. And eventually you come to an agreement, which hopefully includes vaccines, but we also need to respect when it doesn't. This is a healthcare decision. It's got, of course, public impact, but at least for now, it is framed as a personal choice by parents, and that needs to be respected. And it's only through respectful conversations that you're actually more likely to get parents on board with vaccines, because if we begin with the assumption that everyone is trying to do what's best for their kids, then you start it with common ground. And that's where the kind of understanding and engagement can happen.
You've got this chapter that focuses on health experts and how they're framed as heroes. And I just want to read part of it. Quote, "Vaccine proponents use their scientific expertise to debunk vaccine myths while communicating the message that online sources vary in quality. These efforts are not enough because they miss the pressing question of why social media is seen by many media-savvy users to be a good resource for health information. And Dr. Goldenberg, you go on to write, quote, "My thesis is that the answer to this question lies largely in the neglected sources of mistrust. Furthermore, the advice offered by public health communicators to concerned parents to limit their searches for health information to expert-sanctioned resources may further alienate the skeptical publics who are unsatisfied with those expert sources, as it doubles down on the increasingly unpopular and condescending idea that experts know best." Can you put that sentiment into context around COVID and the public discourse here in America? We have seen health experts rise to prominence and also suffer derision at the hands of some of the top political leaders in the country. Help us understand that framing as it relates to our current situation.
Sure. The COVID has been definitely a good case study in the status of experts vis-a-vis the public and government. So you see some really successful cases like Anthony Fauci is now your national hero here in Canada. We like him too, though we have some of our own very effective public health leaders and communicators. But it's what happens is we're seeing the way our experts are sometimes in tension with the government. That was certainly the case with your past president. However, there are also a good body of people that think that expert advice isn't enough because they're worried that experts are playing to the hands of other interests than the public. Sometimes that'll be government interests. Sometimes it'll be corporate interests, too. So what needs to happen is we need to sort of recenter the expert, not as some sort of representative of big government or of big science, but as actually speaking in the interests of the people. So Fauci does well because he's trusted. He's recognized as certainly a high level person. He's got all the epistemic credentials. By that, I mean he's got all the degrees and the information that we need to trust him as an informed resource. But more than that, he is seen as someone who is trustworthy. People think that he's got the public interest in mind. So that tells you something about our experts. They need to be trusted as informational sources, but they also need to be trusted as having goodwill and being interested in the public and our safety, because being smart isn't enough.
We started this conversation, Dr. Goldenberg, by noting how you had spent 5 years researching vaccine hesitancy. And just as you were to submit the final manuscript, COVID showed up. You close the book with a note that you're currently in the fifth month of the COVID pandemic. And now as we talk today, we're past the year point. So I'm wondering, in the months since, is there anything you wish you could have explored further in the context of COVID?
I would have liked to know more about the sources of information and misinformation. So I did a lot of work in the book to try to get us away from the war on science thesis and say, I think that trust and mistrust specifically is at the root of vaccine hesitancy. And I still stand by that. However, I also recognize that our informational landscape is extremely complex. You needed to only look at how conspiracy theories around COVID spread, and through the way that there was a networking of different theories started to converge together. So while I still think the spread and amplification of misinformation conspiracy is rooted in people's feeling of disaffection and lack of connection to social, to government and to broad social networks that are working towards eliminating COVID, I also see that the informational, the networks of information require more attention than just saying it's not just that, it's everything else. So if I would go back, I'd try to get a better sense of how trust and information and misinformation, how they come together and how they are either distorted or amplified as a result of those preliminary or grounding trusting relationships. I'd like to know more about that.
The name of the book is Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. The author is Dr. Maya Goldenberg, an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Guelph. You can hear more from Dr. Goldenberg at a Wednesday night event at the Mercantile Library. It's at 7 o'clock. You can find details at wvxu.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Dr. Goldenberg, thank you so much for the time you gave us. Congratulations on the book, and hopefully we can talk again.
Thanks. I'd love to do that.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.